What's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. As always, thank you for tuning in. We have a very special show for you guys tonight that I'm excited about. We have our special guest here tonight is from Goldback Incorporated, Jeremy Corden. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. I wanted to talk to you specifically because I do feel that, as I've said several times on the show, I spend a lot of time talking about the news of the day and a lot of time on foreign policy, and I probably don't spend enough time talking about monetary policy and economics, which is a real passion of mine. So thank you very much, because I know this is the world you live in. So thanks for joining to talk about it.
Awesome. Super excited to be here.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I've really tried to commit to talking more about this stuff, particularly this year, is that it really is the case that monetary inflation, central banking, is in many ways really the worst problem that we have in America. It's really the issue of our time. And now you even notice all the Democratic candidates are running on unaffordability, but they're very vague with what exactly that means. And of course, the solution is a government program. The median first-time homeowner in this country is now 40 years old. You got to be 40 before you can buy a house and then start thinking about having a family at that point, I guess. And now everybody's spending hundreds of thousands on, you know, to even just try to have a baby. And nobody can afford to get ahead in this world. And that just seems to be more and more kind of the experience of the average American. And I think one of the points that I've always been trying to make is that this is because of this model of central banking and fiat currency and the inflationary environment we live in, where we have a government that we can't afford. So we have to print the money to make it up. And everybody, all regular people end up footing the bill for that, essentially. Is that right?
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. We pay for it with a lower standard of living. I think I was reading today that to have the equivalent of a six-figure salary from 1995, you'd have to be making about $350,000 a year today.
Yeah, that's right. It's like literally it's right in front of you. And as you know, I was talking about this with my buddy Keith Knight the other day, that really if you want to measure wealth, or if you want to measure a standard of living, the only measurement that really makes sense is like how long you have to work for a given product or a given service. You know, like how many hours do you have to work for a chicken? And that's how you measure wealth. It's the only meaningful way to measure wealth. You can look at the GDP or the stock market, but what difference does that make if you don't have stock and you're not participating in the growing GDP? And yeah, I mean, as you put out, we pay for it in our standard of living lowering. And so my father-in-law tells me about this all the time. When he bought his first house in like 1971, and he only made $13,000 a year, but the house was $13,500. It doesn't matter if you're now making $150,000 a year, but the house cost $800,000, then you are poorer than you were making $13,000 a year.
But they've got everybody telling themselves, oh, but I make 13 times the amount of money that I made 50 years ago.
Right.
Or that my grandparents made. And, you know, if I have a six-figure salary now, that's making it. Because when I was growing up, that's what making it looked like. And it's kind of this crazy world where we use the dollar as a measuring stick. And, you know, imagine let's say we use the metric system. But every year they recalibrated the meter to be a little bit shorter.
Right.
And then people started saying ludicrous things like, oh, my house grew 5% this year. We're all getting taller. And like, they just, you know, it's so confusing. It's like you almost don't, it distorts what's really happening when the dollar loses so much value so fast. And it tricks the average person. And that's why we have shrinkflation. You can buy less and less, and the grocery companies are like, oh shoot, we got to raise our prices, but that makes us look like the bad guy. It's like, right. We're the bad guy because we can't keep up. And then you get your 2% raise or your 3% raise at work, or you get your little raise in Social Security. But you know, real inflation, they think just since COVID with all the money printing has been at least 30%. And that was just trillions of dollars that went to what, fraud?
Yeah.
Gone?
Yep, that's right. And I mean, it's one of these interesting things, because I say this a lot of times on the show, but inflation is one of those things that you kind of can't hide from people. You can attempt to, but everybody sees it. Everybody feels it. And so you can even attempt to tell people that Joe Biden isn't senile and keep them away from them as much as possible. You can tell people that we're winning a war over in Afghanistan when we're really losing it, and they don't really see it. So maybe they'll believe you. But try telling people that their grocery bills aren't going up. And try telling them that, like, anybody who goes to the supermarket and has been for the last 5-6 years knows how much poorer you're getting every week. And I guess I just think that in a weird way, you watch people, particularly progressives who are trying to seize on this moment, you watch them spin it in different ways. You know, the problem is that corporate greed spiked. So they'd kind of go along with that perception that, yeah, the problem is the supermarket or the supermarket chain is raising their prices. And I do think it's really important for some of us to come along and go, yeah, but you know how, like, since George W. Bush, they've printed 80% of the money that ever existed? I think that might have something to do with that. Like, just maybe your dollars being less valuable might have something to do with the injection of tens of trillions of dollars of new money, which you would think would be kind of intuitive for people to understand.
You know, I'm old enough where I remember where people used to talk about the national debt. But people would take turns talking about it. It was kind of this political football. Yep. When your guy was in office, you didn't talk about it. The other party talked about it. And when your guy was out of office, you talked about it again. And I remember, you know, during Bush, during Obama, there's kind of this back and forth of whose fault the national debt was and who's mm-hmm. made it worse. And, you know, really, it's just the dollar's just going down and down and down and down. And now there's new threats. You know, they're trying to push through central bank digital currencies now. And they've already done that in parts of the world, like in China, where you have a social credit score and you cannot bank or use your money if your score falls below a certain threshold.
Right. Yeah. And there was just recently a bill about this, right? There was a bill in the Senate, and I think it got defeated, but it is worth pointing out that they are still trying to push this central bank digital currency.
Yeah, and the threat is if cash is gone completely, like physical cash, then you can only use central bank digital tokens. So everybody's in the system. There's no privacy. There's nowhere to run. If, you know, the government doesn't like your show, they don't like, you know, they did this even without central bank digital currencies to, like, the Canadian trucker protesters. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yep.
They debanked them for their protest.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the things that's very concerning. And I think perhaps that because this was more of a Democratic Party idea, and I guess Donald Trump had, there was enough noise from the grassroots that Donald Trump had said, in his campaign, one of his promises was, I guarantee we'll never have a central bank digital currency. Then again, he also said no new wars. Donald Trump had at least brought this up. And that maybe then creates the illusion for people where it's like, all right, well, at least that concern is kind of tabled for now. But of course, you know, even if Donald Trump doesn't break that promise, him breaking the promise on the war has been enough to make him very unpopular and almost guarantee that the Democrats are going to come back into power now. And so that whole threat comes right back to the forefront. And I got to say, that's one that I'm particularly concerned about because, first of all, well, there's a couple things. Number one, clearly our monetary policy is unsustainable. And so we're coming up to kind of like a turning of a chapter here where this can't keep going forever. And so they're going to try to supplement it with something new. And the regime is well aware that they have this major problem right now, which is free speech on the internet. And the fact that the tech censorship has kind of not worked and rolled back, and that now all of the most popular voices are challenging government propaganda. They've got a real issue with this on their hand. And this is one where you go, shoot, how are you going to rein that in? I mean, trying to do tech censorship again is going to be very tough. There are these, websites like Rumble and places where people can go at this point. And also, even if you shut me up or you shut Tucker Carlson up or you shut whoever up, is their audience really going back to Jake Tapper? No, probably not. They're going to find other voices in this space. But you know what really does solve that problem for the regime very nicely is a central bank digital currency where all of a sudden they can monitor, well, what have you been saying online? What have you been doing, you know, wherever? And if they have that, they don't even need to pass an amendment to abolish the First Amendment. They can just say, no, you have the right to say whatever you want to, but we have the right to shut off your bank account.
Oh, it won't even be the government doing it. It'll be their, yeah. It'll be their partners. It'll be the banks.
Right.
And they, right. This already kind of happens. Like, you know, you had Operation Choke Point under Obama, where precious metals dealers and firearms dealers, they were getting debanked and they had to run from bank to bank to bank to, you know, try to figure it out. You know, we've dealt with this problem at Goldback, where the bank just says, gee, the regulators are putting a lot of pressure on us. We don't know if we can continue this banking relationship. And I know it happens to influencers too. But, you know, we have some, at least we have like a bunch of different banks. But if you centralize that control and you make it uniform, like in China, you can just bankrupt all of your opponents and make it so scary. You know, China, they don't even talk about politics. It's too dangerous to talk about politics. It's just, you know, it's not safe. You're looking at being homeless and not being able to feed your family and on and on and on. So, you know, there's the central bank digital currency threat. But even if we don't go there, like even if that doesn't happen and we can stave that off, if you were to measure the value of the dollar in gold, so 100 years ago, an ounce of gold was about $20. And it was a $20 gold piece. It wasn't exactly an ounce, but it was about that. It was the double eagle. And that was just the money. And today, I want to say gold's like $4,500.
Yep.
So just measuring the dollar in gold, it's lost like what, 99.6% of its value?
And just to give people some perspective on that, no, that's exactly right. And also just, if you could just measure like, so you're going 100 years ago, you're putting it at about $30 an ounce. And then by the Bretton Woods Agreement, right? So this is like what, 1944?
Mm-hmm.
So 20 years into it's at $35 an ounce.
Yep.
Then by the year 2000, it's at like $300 an ounce. So like, oh, wow, it's 10 times less. But you could see how, and then how rapidly the dollar has been destroyed recently, that we're now between $4,000 and $5,000 for an ounce. And I don't know, this is going back a while that I had read this, but there's these interesting things. The reason why measuring it in gold is not just like an arbitrary measure is that gold is very unique in the fact that it preserves its purchasing power. I know what people would say, like, you know, like an ounce of gold, they say in ancient Rome would get you like a toga and a headpiece and a pair of shoes. Like it would essentially get you like a suit for that time. And in 1948, $35 would like get you a nice suit and a hat and a pair of shoes. And in the year 2026, an ounce of gold will get you like a suit and a hat and a pair of shoes. It's like, it is almost like representing almost the same amount of purchasing power. And so, man, is it creepy to look at that and then go, yeah, that's literally what this policy has done. They've robbed 99% of the wealth of your dollar that you're holding.
Yeah, they robbed 99% and then another 60% after that. So if you had if you have a $100 bill today, it would be like less than a dollar 100 years ago in purchasing power.
Yeah,
or another way to look at that, like the penny, the wheat penny, that guy had about $2.50 worth of purchasing power. And that was the smallest amount of money they even bothered with. If it was less than $2.50, like forget it. And in that context, all of our change is obsolete. Quarters are obsolete. Half dollars obsolete, dimes, nickels, all of it's obsolete. I mean, when was the last time you cared to count up and add up your change?
No, it's like a thing that my kids put in their piggy bank as like a game, but it's not really like, you know what I mean? It's just like, oh, that's what I do anytime I have a coin, which is rare that I have them. And it's also worth pointing out that, you know, when you have this inflationary economy, right? So like when you start from that point and you keep diluting the currency until we get to where we are today, this, of course, is essentially, in effect, a giant welfare program for the rich. You just transfer money upward and upward and upward, because if the value of the dollar is going down, well, then people who own things are benefiting from that. If it were, or at least you're keeping up if you own something, because the thing you own is worth a lot more than it previously was. So that's okay for people who own a lot of stuff. It's great for people who are in huge amounts of debt. And when I say debt, I don't mean like you have a little bit of credit card debt. I mean debt like you have borrowed billions of dollars from the bank but to start some, you know, new enterprise, and now you only really in effect got to pay back millions. But for people on a fixed income, for working class people, for middle class people, as everybody around them can see, it's just absolute death. The guy who was making 70 grand a year was doing great 10 years ago, and now he's struggling to get by. It's just ruined,
ruins regular people's lives. It's hard to even diagnose the problem. It's just like, man, like costs have gone up. I don't know why houses, you know, everyone's so greedy on their houses. If you were to measure housing in gold, if you looked at the U.S. stock market measured in gold, the U.S. stock market has been down since like the year 2000.
Right.
If you measure it in gold, it's just the value is not there. The prices are overinflated because everyone's pushing their IRA money into it. And, you know, in terms of real value, it's just it really changes what the economics landscape looks like. We're not hitting all-time records in the stock market if you measure it in something that isn't constantly losing value. And, you know, we talk about this, and maybe the reason why you don't talk about it more is because there's not like really a whole lot to be done about it. So you come from a similar background. You know, I came into this whole thing as a Ron Paul guy. I was 21 years old when he ran for president the second time, and I went and got elected to be a Ron Paul delegate. And one of the things that he talked about a lot was just this issue. He had the book and the Fed. You know, central banking is the biggest issue. And there's a problem because you can't really return to the gold standard. This is something I've been super obsessed with and have researched it a lot. There's a few problems. Even if we, you know, libertarians won, Congress is full of, you know, Masseys. We got Ron Paul into the Fed, or some Ron Paul type guy into the Fed. He's a little old now. Maybe Ron Paul doesn't want that job.
Give him a break. Let him relax. Let him
relax. But, you know, you figure you win. Going back to the gold standard that we had 100 years ago, it used up all of the nation's copper. It used up 90% of the nation's silver. And now 80% of silver is tied up in industrial demand. 99% of copper is tied up in industrial demand. And even then, like BRICS countries that are like looking to go to the gold standard, they can't figure out how to do it because the gold standard essentially failed, because its main central point of failure was, is it in the vault? Does Fort Knox even have the gold? Is the gold even there? They couldn't figure out how to divide an ounce of gold. So what you had to divide it with was copper tokens, which were sold for like 4,000% above their melt value. Silver tokens that were bigger. And I call them tokens because you take 2 cents worth of silver and mint it into a coin that said 10 cents on it. That's essentially what constitutional silver was. So there was a huge markup and a profit to be had in making coinage. And you'd think if anything should be profitable, it should be literally making money, right? And then a lot of those $20 gold coins out there that were to kind of back up the whole system, there just weren't a lot of them. The banks didn't have a lot of them. You had a lot of bills, $100 bills. There's $10,000 bills, $50,000. There's a $100,000 bill. You know how valuable that is, considering that gold was $20 an ounce? And they would use these for like interbank transfers in the U.S.
Yeah, so they didn't have the gold.
But I mean, like if you were to measure all the gold that the gold standard actually had, it might be like 5 to 10% of the gold standard was backed by actual gold at the melt value. Like that was it. So you can't really go back to that because the trust isn't there.
Right.
Like, so, you know, the bridge is burned. So then what do? You just stay in, you know, central bank inflationary hell. You know, like there's not a great solution. So it's almost like something that's not really people talk about, because it's like, well, what do you do? You know, like, what do we do? How do we fix it?
Right. Right. All right. So where does your company, where does Goldbeck come in on that?
Okay. So what we do is we go out, and the 2,000 year old problem with gold. So this isn't just a problem 100 years ago or 50 years ago. In Roman times, it was a problem. Is you can't really fractionalize gold down that small. You have to use bronze. You have to use silver. You have to do something else because the gold is just so valuable. What Goldbeck has done, what we've done with Goldbeck, is we've taken that 1 ounce and we've split it with microchip technology into 4,000 pieces. And in a way that has never been counterfeited and wouldn't be easy to counterfeit. So it's, you know, this is a...
Which is as much as you can say for any paper currency. It's not, you know, like not easy. Anything, I guess, is theoretically possible to counterfeit.
Theoretically.
You make it very hard to do so. Yeah.
We raise the bar really, really high. You're not looking at $100,000 worth of equipment. You're looking at $20 million worth of equipment and 10 years of dicking around to try to, you know, make it look the same. So, you know, you want to raise that bar all the time to just make it like more obnoxious for counterfeiters. So the quarter gold back has the same value as a wheat penny did 100 years ago. So it's like a $2.50 gold product. It's the cheapest gold product in the entire world. We mass produce it. We've got the one gold back. And the idea here, the drive with gold back, is we're trying to kind of reimagine and restore the gold standard in the private sector and invite people to participate. And so far it's gone really well. There are more places in the United States that take payment in gold, you know, a la Goldbeck, than there are locations that take Walmart gift cards.
And so the idea is here to essentially create a gold standard for a private currency. And so that there's, you know, like you at least in a sense, it's like an opt-out option from the dollar, but potentially ultimately.
Yeah, because there are people today that do 70, 80% of their financial life in gold.
Yeah.
There are cities today that have dozens of industries that participate, you know, grocery stores, gas stations, entertainment, healthcare, insurance, contractors, dollar stores, you name it, people that do your yard. You know, landscaping people, they all take payment in gold backs and they're all driving distance. So it's becoming more and more possible, you know, the more and more we grow the network. And, you know, you imagine you get debanked and it's like, hey, you're kind of screwed if there's no cash alternative and there's nothing you can do. And you don't really want to come up with a solution on that day. You don't want to say, okay, you know, we have a big problem. We're all bankrupt but we have things that we can trade, you know, like what if we, you know, you want to start building up solutions well in advance. And, you know, I think the reason why gold bullion and silver bullion haven't really taken off, like that was the first thing I tried to do. The reason why they haven't really taken off is because they're not really a system of money. So if you buy an ounce of gold, that doesn't have an equal value to 10th ounce coins.
Right. Like,
they have different premiums. They have different values. A lot of gold coins are fake. You have to have an $800 Sigma machine to like really know for sure if it's real. You know, and it's not an easy enough system where people actually do that. So we wanted to make something that looked and felt like cash that people could intuitively understand and get on board with, where, you know, it wasn't like some high friction transaction.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting idea because and part of the reason why I'm interested in this stuff is that, yeah, like you said, we have to begin to look for solutions to this kind of coming problem. And as I'm sure you also being an old school Ron Paul guy, I came in 08. I'm a little older than you, or a lot older than you, but it makes older people sound good when you go, a little bit older than you. You know, we can't look to government to be the ones who are going to create this type of stuff, because that's a game that you'll die waiting if you're waiting for.
You're not going to vote government. Yourself out of the central bank problem.
Yeah.
If it's a system that primarily benefits people with massive amounts of debt and assets, who do you think the donor class is? Why would they ever change the game? Because it's the donor class getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and the average person getting more and more and more poor. And if there's a labor shortage, like, let's just import tens of millions of people, you know, like, let's, you know, just be poor, you know, like, suck it up, you know, like, that's seems to be. The
yeah,
message.
It's no, you're absolutely right. And look, I mean, we're recording this. It's the day after Thomas Massey lost his primary. And it does kind of show you something about, like, you could have this guy who's an enormously popular congressman in his district who gets in trouble for taking enormously popular stances on big issues like opposing the war in Iran or being for the Epstein files being declassified. I mean, these are like 80% of the American people are with him on this. But the money isn't. And so they've pumped $32 million into his district and they get him out. So again, to your point, when there's a system that benefits those who hold tremendous debt and those who hold tremendous assets, if you want to go one-on-one versus Goldman Sachs, they're going to come out having more debt and assets than you. And they're going to come out having a whole lot more political influence than you. And so these, like, I'm not against government solutions, but I think sometimes there is this almost like a bias people have where they go, if you try to come up with some private solution to the problem, they go, oh, that's a little pie in the sky. You know, what are the odds that we're actually going to get people all trading in these gold backs? But then you go, as opposed to what? As opposed to thinking that the democratic process is going to yield some type of results where you have to directly take on all these big money interests that are always going to have more influence than you. I mean, seems to me like trying to come up with some type of private solution is the only viable
solution. So we're not the first company to do this. There has been, according to Wikipedia, as much as you can trust that, over 2,000 local currency projects in the United States. And a lot of those, you know, they're around for 10, 20 years, then they disappear. Hundreds of these things popped up during the Great Depression. It happened in Greece during their banking crisis. Because if the money doesn't work and it doesn't work for everybody, you know, the bottom comes out. And I was going to ask you, I mean, if we lost 99.6 something percent of our value in the last 100 years, what's the next 100 years going to look like?
And we seem to be going at a faster pace.
It's probably worse. I mean, 99.6 is like, but even if that's like just as good, you know, as what happened the last 100 years, like, what does that mean for your savings?
Yeah.
Like, does it make absolutely. Sense to save? Do you just not save? Do you just invest in every speculative thing and just, you know, have a whole society of people like that? And then, you know, we kind of drift. Because here's the thing, you can boycott a central bank digital currency with cash today. Cash is another central bank product.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, it's all almost kind of like sad watching libertarians be like, no, don't get rid of cash. It's like, still the central bank, guys.
Yeah, that was the last thing we were against. Now we're begging to keep it.
Yeah, it's just like, and it's better than, like, you know, being out of the frying pan and into the fire, but like, you're still begging for the frying pan.
Yeah. Yeah, you're still trading in Federal Reserve notes, you know? And so, yeah, no, that's a fair point. And of course, as everybody knows, you know, like in all those scenarios, you know, wheelbarrow full of cash, hyperinflation type scenarios, people want your jewelry or they want your products or something, right? You have to find some other way to trade. And so it does seem like you want to give people at least the best fighting chance they have.
Yeah, you make the best possible product you can. You know, I'd say gold back, if you're going to own 1/1000th of an ounce of gold, this is the cheapest way to do it. It's not even close. We have the cheapest kind of hyper fractional gold. And, you know, like the high denomination gold backs, once you get up to like the 50 or the 100, there are cheaper ways to own gold closer to spot, but then you're not really part of like a system of like interchangeable money.
Right. And there's not, say, like in a scenario, because almost like just from like the preparedness aspect of it, it's like, you know, if you're waiting for the moment when the dollar crashes and you have a whole bunch of gold bars in your house, in your safe or something like that, you know, forget if you're having it like professionally stored or own a fund or something, forget that. But yeah, like GLD. Even if you just have, yeah, that's not going to cut it. but if you just have a bunch of gold bars, you're still going to have the problem of like, but how are you going to effectively trade that for something? Because what, you got like a $5,000 gold bar or something like that?
Yeah, a little cheese grater. Okay. You're going to, you know,
You're going to find yourself in a tough situation. So that is very interesting. Well, let people know. So if they wanted to purchase these, where do they go?
So if you want to buy them, we have about 600 dealers that sell gold backs. We have a list on goldback.com. If you want to sign up your business, if you want to take payment in gold, you could also sign up your business on goldback.com and give credit to Dave that supports the show. So there's a few different ways to get involved. And, you know, in terms of local currencies, most local currencies cap out at about 100 businesses in like a little regional area that participate. You know, Goldback, we have like 5,500, 5,400 right now in the United States. And we're primarily concentrated in specific states. We've got California coming out. We've started in states like New Hampshire and Utah. We've got a gold back in Florida, but people are starting to trade these all over the country. And we're seeing more and more business networks getting developed in places where we don't even have like a main series.
It's very interesting. Very interesting. So like, even if you're not in one of those areas, people can still know what it is. They can verify that it's real. They can look it up. Like there's a system of being, of people being able to verify that, like, oh, okay, this is legit. I really like the implications of it for like, I don't know, as I get older, I do think more and more about preparedness and stuff like that. And as the world gets crazier and crazier, and it is the type of thing that, like, in a real disaster scenario, you would like to have some of these.
Absolutely. I mean, as a preparedness thing, absolutely. And that's kind of where we started the company. It was kind of like, hey, you should have food storage and you should have some spendable gold.
Right.
Like, and I wasn't like that worried about getting people to do it. I thought, hey, maybe we can go out and we can sign up some businesses because too many people ask, oh, what would I do with it? It's like, well, you know, I mean, it's gold. You could trade it with people. Like, yeah, but who would ever take that? Who would ever accept gold? You know, you can just hear it, right?
Yeah.
Like who is the guy that did like the gold bar in, where was it? Like in California. And he was like asking people if they wanted a gold bar or like a Hershey's bar.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've seen people do that with Bitcoin, do that with gold bars, and then people
remember who that was.
The candy bar. Yeah, I vaguely remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, like a lot of people don't know. And I thought, hey, you know, maybe there's like 10% of business owners are queued in and, you know, they're going to do this and we can sign them up and we can kind of at least have someone we can point at and say, hey, these 10 businesses or these 100 businesses will do it at the value that, you know, these guys have in a given day. And what we've quickly found out is something like half of small business owners will take payment in gold. It's not 5 or 10%, it's like half. Well, they're entrepreneurs and you know, they're experts at taking appropriate risks.
Right. That's without the dollar crashing, you know what I mean? Like even more, that's without us being in an even worse state than we are now. No, I mean, I really do think a lot about this, like, we're going to have to come up with solutions because, like I said, like you can't sit around waiting for the government on this. And as you were kind of getting at, you know, as bad as things are now, what happens when we just keep devaluing the currency even more? And if there's one thing that is clear in the political landscape of America today, it's that we're going to continue devaluing the currency. And there simply is no other option. We cannot afford the government that we have. We can't afford even close to it. And currently, we have the Republicans who are asking for a $1.5 trillion defense budget. No one is thinking about talking about entitlement reform, let alone, you know, entitlement abolition. And as long as that's the case, and Democrats are promising even more social services, they're going to keep doing this. So where do we go when the median, you know, household, first-time household buyer isn't 40? but they're 50 or 60. And where do we go when kids? Yeah.
If something can't continue forever, then at some point it has to stop.
Yep.
When gold bags came out, they came out 7 years ago. They were like $2 and now they're like $9.
Yeah.
Like that's, I didn't think it was going to be that much. There's a third of $1 billion worth of gold backs out there.
Oof.
So it's like really big and like really small at the same time. That's not huge compared to the whole gold market. But if you measure it by units, gold backs are the number one most produced gold product in the entire world now in 7 years.
Wow. That is pretty incredible. Well, Jeremy, I really appreciate you taking the time today. Is there anything else you want to tell people about before we go?
You know, something else that's encouraging is most of the people buying gold backs, they're our age. 70% of buyers are between the ages of 20 and like 45.
Huh. Yeah, well, that is another encouraging sign. It's something I've been thinking about with the Thomas Massey race, just because, you know, there was such a big split by age.
Oh, it's a huge split.
Yeah. That was the whole thing. Yeah. It was the whole election was like how old you are. And you do think that, like, you know, this whole system is kind of married to the boomers, and it's guys in that age bracket that you just said who are going to be coming into that slot over the next few years. And it's going to be on us to be looking for these solutions.
Absolutely. I mean, that generation, they're going to age out, and that's probably the most encouraging thing. You know, as a libertarian, like, you know, we kind of lose a lot.
we sure do.
And it sucks. But, you know, long term, like decades down the road, I think we're going to be fine. There's just, if we can make it that far, you know, if we can make it 10, 20 years, like a lot of these people, you know, the Pelosi's and the Schumer's and the McConnell's and, you know, Trump's of the world, the Biden's, they're all gone.
No, that's right. And people who are much more open to these ideas are left behind. So that is an encouraging thought that we needed. So Jeremy Corden, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
All right. Have a good one. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Catch you next time. Peace.